Welcome to the Create Something Awesome Today podcast, where it's all about educating and motivating creative pros and entrepreneurs from around the world with simple and easy to implement ideas. And of course, helping you create something awesome today. And now, welcome your host. He is the founder of Awesome Creator Academy, a YouTube educator, and the biggest Star Wars nerd you'll ever meet, Roberto Blake.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Create Something Awesome Today podcast. This is your host, Roberto Blake, helping you create something awesome today. Welcome to a Night Owl edition if you happen to be live. If you are catching the replay or the audio only, I'm doing a late night episode of the podcast. I'd kind of meant to do one earlier in the day, and somehow I decided that I think I'm just going to try to do the podcast almost every day in December now. So that is what it looks like we're doing. So in the spirit of getting it done before we hit midnight and go into the next day, I decided, you know what, let's do a Saturday night edition of the podcast. Even if everyone can't join live, I would get a couple of the night owls together and you guys can enjoy the replay. If you are not part of the live viewing experience, there's always the audio in Apple, Spotify, Google Play, and anywhere else that podcasts are available. And it does mean that I get to hang out with the people who are live. And of course, we get to talk about content. So today, what we're going to be talking about is my 2022 plans, my absurd, insane, and ambitious plans around content strategy, social media, and making 1,000 pieces of content next year, which is really interesting considering that in 2021, I don't think I uploaded even 50 videos to YouTube in 2021. I think this is actually the year since 2014 or 2015 that I've uploaded the least amount of content to my main YouTube channel with 500,000 subscribers that I ever have. And it's definitely the least I've done since hitting 100,000 back in 2016, 100,000 subscribers. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to be talking about what my plan for 2022 is. And that might actually inspire or help some of you with your plans for 2022 when it comes to building out your content strategy, monetizing, scaling your audience, any number of those things. So that's what we're going to be talking about in this episode. But before we get too heavily into that, I do want to talk about our wonderful sponsors.
We thrive thanks to the support from our sponsors. Here's a word from one of them.
You know, I actually have recently invested in a very important creator economy startup called Creative Juice. And in partnering with them, it's actually really helped me with a lot of my brand deals, specifically because with their Juice bank accounts, I've been able to directly invoice for free for some of my brand deals. And I can tell you from personal experience that this is actually a much better experience than me using invoicing software that I've had to pay $40 a month for, or directly invoicing through PayPal, because with the PayPal fees, I ended up on a $5,000 invoice spending $150 just to receive money and then transfer it to my bank account. With a Creative Juice bank account, I haven't had to have those same processing fees through the traditional processors, and I haven't had to pay the $40 a month just to be able to invoice for my brand deals. So this is something that could save you hundreds to thousands of dollars as a content creator throughout your career. So make sure you're checking out Creative Juice, linked in the description down below. Also, if you're into live streaming and podcasting, make sure you're checking out StreamYard, which is also linked down below, the best solution in live streaming, the simplest solution in live streaming, because we are now simulcasting to Facebook, a Facebook group, a LinkedIn live page, a YouTube channel, and Twitter, all in real time. So make sure you're checking out StreamYard, is linked down below, robertoblake.com/go/StreamYard. You can sign up for a free account, experience it for yourself. Same goes for Creative Juice. You can sign up for an absolutely free account. So I definitely recommend you do that. $0, no risk to you, and you can experience it for yourself and see how great these things are. Thank you again to our wonderful sponsors. So let's talk about my 2022 strategy. And as you might have imagined, brand deals themselves are a big part of my 2022 strategy, but so is expanding and diversifying the types of content that I'm doing. Even with doing the podcast more consistently, this is part of a strategy that I have. Same thing for doing the podcast and simulcasting it across multiples of my platforms. By being able to do the live stream podcast on a regular basis, and I don't know that it will be daily because obviously that would get me one third of the way to 1,000 pieces of content right then and there, but you have to think about this. Doing the podcast is going to allow me to have a consistent piece of content. And let's say, for example, what if I did the podcast 2 or 3 times a week? Or what if I did the podcast Monday through Friday for an hour as a live stream? Well, all of a sudden, if I were doing the podcast, let's just say it's Monday through Friday. Well, right off the bat, I'm getting about maybe doing that 250 pieces of content on every platform that I'm streaming it to in a year if I do that for 2022. And I'm not saying that I'll do Monday through Friday, but what if I did? Well, that scales my content because now that's 250 pieces of content for Facebook. That's 250 pieces of content for LinkedIn, 250 pieces of content for YouTube, and certainly 250 pieces of content for Twitter. That would get me 1,000 pieces of content right then and there. But wait, there's more. I can take every one of these podcast episodes, and just depending on how I structure them, I could probably get another 3 pieces of clip show content out of the podcast. So I can already repurpose episodes of the podcast into a clips show, a clips channel, house that somewhere on YouTube, but I could also post those clips to multiples of my platforms. And that's not even including Spotify video through Anchor. Spotify is going to be competitive with YouTube in that way. They're already taking creators on if you go through the application process and if you go through Anchor. And so all of a sudden, I have these multiple platforms to do that. I obviously am going to get the audio podcast and I get to have that in Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Google Play Store, multiple different podcast distribution platforms. So if I were to do a Monday through Friday podcast, get 250 episodes out, well, just in audio only, I end up with 1,000 pieces of content, more than 1,000 pieces of content. So the thing is, I probably could have changed the title of this episode to say my insane plan for making 10,000 pieces of content. Because if you really think about it, the audio only side would give me maybe 1,000 to 2,000 pieces of content as far as the podcast. The same thing with repurposing the live stream and simulcasting. By simulcasting, if I go Monday through Friday, 5 days a week throughout the whole year, then that would give me 250 episodes, but 1,000 pieces of content across the video platforms. But then on top of that, if I take this and I'm getting multiple clip shows episodes, let's say I'm getting even 6 episodes or 5 clips, sorry, not episodes, 5 or 6 clips out of every single one of these episodes. Well, that's 1,000 pieces of now micro content right then and there to repurpose to Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, and possibly IGTV. So all of a sudden, or even Spotify video potentially. So there's all of these different opportunities for that. I could even probably consider reposting clips to Twitch as VODs. I have a Twitch account. I'm a Twitch affiliate. I could be doing that. And so there's all these opportunities for repurposing the content. And so that's just powerful. So technically, it wouldn't be that hard to get to a place to where all of a sudden the podcast alone could be turned into thousands of pieces of content. We haven't even touched the idea that I could take the podcast and I could clip segments for YouTube Shorts and then scale that across multiple platforms as well. So just the podcast alone and doing that as a live stream and taking an hour to do that, an hour out of my time to do the podcast, sets me up for multiple pieces of content. And then there's more. If I structure the podcast in such a way to where at the end of the show, I take advantage of the fact that I have a live viewing audience for the chat. I could basically turn the end of the show after cutting the audio recording portion off, and for the live YouTube experience and Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and so on and so forth, I could take that experience and I could have lightning round Q&As where you could ask Roberto, and then I can create hashtag ask Roberto. I could promote this on Twitter to get more people into the podcast and to show. And I could sit there and I could do rapid fire lightning round questions. I can get clips out of that. I can get YouTube shorts out of that. I can get so Instagram reels. I can get so many things out of doing lightning round at the end of the show, cutting that out of the audio only podcast for the recording to be clean. And now I have this content that's slightly more exclusive and can be micro content to be able to use multiple places. And so I can get another 10 pieces of content guaranteed out of every single episode. So that's just the podcast, y'all. I mean, isn't that crazy? Think about that strategy. Think about what I just outlined for you. I just guaranteed that I can get multiple YouTube shorts, Instagram reels, TikToks out of the end of the podcast to rapid fire questions. I can get clips and I can get micro content even from that. So the podcast has unlimited potential between live streams, stream of consciousness, info dumps, structured content, interviews. Sky's the limit on that. And we're not even talking about the weekends where I stream with Viper on the main YouTube channel. We're not talking about my long form content on the main YouTube channel. We're not talking about how I can repurpose my 15 tips style videos or any of my listicle videos into micro content. We're not even talking about the fact that every podcast episode also can become an article, blog post, or multiple articles. We're not talking about the fact that all of my interviews can somehow be aggregated and repurposed, future for ebooks potentially. I can repurpose my interviews and my asking questions of guests and aggregate those for future ebook content later too, and for anecdotes. And so then that becomes powerful. There's also the fact that with all of those podcast episodes and interviews on top of those these articles that I could be doing, I could take every podcast episode, break it down into a summary of five main points, and get another piece of content out of those 5 points. Those 5 points can be made into slides. Those slides and infographics can be made and repurposed to platforms like Pinterest out of that information, or out of the big key moments or the key takeaways from that. So all the key moments, all the key takeaways, all of those things can be massively powerful in terms of what they end up leading to when it comes to new content opportunities and opportunities for other platforms there. And so that's just the podcast channel. And then that doesn't account for the fact that I don't have to do the editing and the chop up and the remixing for that. I can do that. Or if I get to work with a company like Jellysmack, Jellysmack can do that for me, or I can have someone on my team do that for me. And so then from a outsourcing and a productivity and a practicality standpoint, I'm just creating the foundational content and the source material for them to then make derivative content from. And see, this is what's going to be so impactful. And this is what's going to ultimately scale my brand in the future and make it more evergreen, more relevant in real time, and more everlasting. And so it gives me more content that can be in a very practical way, scalable, evergreen, timely, relevant. It gives me all of those things, right? And it allows me to maximize on every content format, because with clips, I can get concise things out of the clips that might be really good content that is from 2 minutes to 6 minutes, that is digestible for people not familiar with me and gets to the point and gets them the most important thing that they want, right? I can get people the most important thing that they might want from me by having that medium form content that exists in a window between 2 minutes and maybe 6 minutes, right? At the same time, a live stream for an hour or an hour and change is still something that there's an audience for that wants depth, wants more of my opinion driven content, wants more of my commentary, wants more access to me, more engagement. Again, if you're in the live right now, feel free to say hi. Make sure you're smashing the like button. Then there's the opportunity to interact with me, maybe see your name come up on a screen. There are those things that people want from a live viewing experience. There's the depth that people want from long form content. And then the audio experience means that people can listen to it on the road, or they can replay the live on YouTube while they're working, while they're driving. The things that go around that are just massively endless in terms of listenable content, but also content that has high levels of replay value. And so that reusable content is something that, again, expands the footprint of my brand in a way that it might not for other creators. And so being able to be in that position, it also gives me every content format that I need. It gives me the long form content that YouTube and other platforms are valuing in terms of content that can keep, even if it's a niche audience, keeping long form listeners and viewers and live stream audiences on these platforms long term is valued, and it does grow your authority in these platforms to have long form content. You've seen that with Twitch and YouTube especially, that live streaming has been extraordinarily powerful for their platforms. LinkedIn Live has been extraordinarily powerful for that platform. Amazon Live has become the new QVC. And so those things are massive. But the other extreme is the extreme short form vertical video content. So long form live stream content in widescreen, HD content, is one extreme that we've seen most of the platforms adopt. They've adopted video in a very general way. They copied YouTube on that, but now they're copying TikTok on shorts. So when we look at the primary player platforms, I feel like it's very much still a YouTube, Twitch, TikTok type world, but don't underestimate Facebook and Instagram, because they're moving in on monetization as the thing that makes people attracted to their platform is going to be the monetization thing. So Hero Vation says, so Gary Vee has been right all along. Well, yes, and I've never said otherwise. I'm not a Gary Vee hater or doubter. I'm actually a fan. But what I will say is this. Gary Vee's thesis is correct, but everybody has to figure out what version of a strategy makes sense for them and why it makes sense for them. And also, there are other plays here. Here's another level. Another level of it is the Mr. Beast strategy. There's content I'm looking at and thinking to myself, how can I make content in the future that makes sense to dub into other languages and repurpose my content to be dubbed into other languages? And so what has really occurred to me is, in the future, I want to make I know that YouTube in particular, and the creator economy as a whole, but like YouTube in particular is going to have global world dominance and is being adopted in nations outside the West that are non-English speaking. And I've seen the future. And those are larger population centers than the English speaking Western market in a lot of cases, right? And so what the future holds, but entertainment content is the thing that is being proliferated there. And that means that education content has an opportunity, because it's not going to be a saturated market. You're going to have people like Mr. Beast, Mark Rober, and other people taking their most entertaining. You're going to have these viral video creators. You're going to have these entertainers that are viral video creators that are going to make content and then have it redubbed and published in these large population centers. They're going to make content in Brazilian Portuguese, Portuguese for the Brazil and other international speaking audience, Spanish, Korean, Hindi for the Indian speaking population. They're going to go to these mass population centers where there are not larger than life established content creators already that are homegrown content creators. They're going to make native language content for those communities And they're going to do it redubbed, and it's going to be done in a high quality. And so that's the future. And since I know for a fact that that is the future, and that those are population centers that have not fully embraced the internet, meaning that there's still more market potential, market penetration to be had for the rest of the non-English speaking world, that's the future. So since I know that, then what I know is that if I start making education content that is relevant to a global audience and not just a Western audience, and that is niche specific in enough verticals and does not rely on you being a fan of my personality, then I know I can win and I can dominate those markets early, and that no one else that might be in those markets already has my same understanding of YouTube as a platform, has my same level of production and my same level of success, or the resources to build a team around them. So my answer to that is there is a future where I make PBS style like content as far as education content, tutorials, tips, and tricks for things. And so that might mean I literally make a channel that is a software tutorial channel where I basically do what I did in the early days of my YouTube career. What if I just teach tutorials and software, and I do things around Adobe software and open source and Canva? So things that are either very professional so they can work in the Western world professionally, or things that are open source and free. So what if I do a lot more content like that? And then what if I have it recreated and repurposed and redubbed in the major language population centers? Boom. And I can easily get to monetization on all of those channels and have all of that content and have the ownership and own the markets in perpetuity. I can also make an infotainment style channel around something that might be financially interesting or have the words money in it or something like that. Maybe I do something where I do video mini docs about very famous wealthy people, and then I have that be a faceless YouTube channel so that now it's just interesting people and anyone in the world can consume this and care about it. And then these are global public figures. It's all historically relevant information. And boom, by making a history but tying it to money type channel, I have the highest CPMs even globally. Even in countries where the CPMs are low, I'd still make money, and I make that content. And it's not even that I have to make that content every week. It's that I could make 20 videos a year or less on that content around a team, maybe hire different talent to help me with that, do what I need to do, help me mostly probably work on the script writing for that. Boom. I immediately then end up with a scalable channel that can be purposed in any language and off to the races, and those channels can be successful and they can grow. With the core being getting an English-speaking channel up and running first around the same concept. So you see, I can win on that level, and that's a future long-term play for me over the next 3 to 5 years, is doing those kind of things and running those channels in a more automated fashion than my main channel, because my main channel mostly relies on me being Roberto Blake. That's the main channel. So when you think about it, it's absurdly practical to do, and it's a long-term value play, and it serves an underserved market and an underserved community. It is an opportunity that a lot of people are not looking at, and it's an opportunity that most people may not have the ability to execute on at the level that I could because of an experience barrier and a resource barrier. And so that would be the reasons why, well, okay, why hasn't everyone done that? Most people don't make education content on YouTube because they don't have enough experience, expertise, or ability in anything to justify them teaching it, number one. Number two, even if they did, they can't necessarily make good and effective content in YouTube in that way. And then number three, they don't have the resources, infrastructure, and team to do it consistently and scale it and monetize it, nor the ability to invest in it at a potential loss up front. So those variables disqualify people from being able to do what I talk about in this particular instance. It is a play that only works for somebody with experience, expertise, and disposable capital and resources. So that's why again, ideas aren't everything. You have to have the ability and capacity to execute on them, and the execution still has to be done well, and you still risk failure even then, and you have to be able to confront that. So that was like, so, you know, that's just something to bring up here in terms of another practicality play, but that's content I haven't even started on yet. If we go back and we think about what I'm going to do for the main channel in 2022, that actually gets really interesting. So Evie asked a question here, and I do want to get to this question. Do the captions change to other languages when you make videos already? I'm not sure. It does not automatically do that. What it does do, Evie, is we do get YouTube's auto captioning, but that's not always as accurate as one would hope. And so even translating that, if it's auto-generated to other language, is not always as accurate as it needs to be for that audience. However, you can pay for services like Rev.com, or if you have software like mine, I have Adobe Premiere Pro. And so with the Adobe Creative Cloud and Adobe Sensei, I can actually get closed captionings. I'm already paying $60 a month for Adobe. So I can get closed captionings by running it through my software, do very minimal corrections, and it's good to go. So it's a round trip process that I could probably, no matter how long most of my videos are, spend all of 5 or 10 minutes to just make sure it's right. Or I could even hand that off to somebody on my team and they could make sure it's right after I auto-generate the captions, have them do the corrections, upload it to the back end for me since they're already, you know, getting paid, and then it's done. And so that would be my workflow for having accurate captions. And then after that, someone on my team could plug those into Google's Translate, and then that probably gets as close as possible to accurate translations for other countries. It is something we are planning to play with a lot more, in particular, even for the podcast. So it's just something to think about. So Hero says, so the idea is to take advantage of the open markets by repurposing your content for that audience. Yes and no. So my thesis is this: repurpose content you already have, yes, and wherever you can, absolutely, but also simultaneously to look at opportunities for open markets to make new original content and to exploit a lack of people being served. If people are not being served, an opportunity exists that nobody is jumping in on. And again, the thing that is attractive to most of the people in the content creation game, most people in the content creation game today are going to be under 25. Here's the advantage for someone like me who's over 35. I'm 37 as of the making of this particular podcast episode. The advantage of someone who's over 35 is lived experience and qualified expertise, at least, again, someone who's worked in a career, a profession, or a trade for many years. You can then have the ability to claim a decade plus of experience in something, which is very important. And that means that you have the ability at that point to not just be an entertainer. And there's nothing wrong with being an entertainer. Entertainment is the most saturated market that there is, though. Making entertaining content is the most saturated market. It's also, again, the broadest market and opportunity for appeal, but it's also the one with the highest level of competition. And why? Because it has the lowest barrier to entry. If you think about strategy and you think about YouTube, you give a primary example. Why is gaming saturated? Why is commentary saturated? Well, I'm not disrespecting any creator who makes that content, but I will say this, and I think they'll admit it. It is the lowest barrier to entry, easiest content for anyone under 25 years old to make, and is the easiest content to make at the lowest cost. So if you're under 25, you don't have a lot of money, and you don't have a lot of real world experience or expertise or a high level of talent or competency in anything, opinion-based commentary, reacting to reaction channels, commentary channels, and gaming channels attract the audience of young people, and it's where most YouTube content creators and online content creators who are young start their career. And it's because what's the cost of doing really good commentary videos? To produce really good commentary videos, you do not need a lot of money. What's the expertise to do really good commentary videos? You have to learn how to make decent YouTube thumbnails. You have to be aware of the market. You just basically have to be part of the culture and part of the community. And you have to be able to produce acceptable level content. It doesn't have to be a cinematic masterpiece of any kind. So the barrier to entry is low. The threshold of what quality content is what acceptable content is pretty low as far as production and editing. And the same thing with gaming and the same thing with doing a reaction channel. You do not have to go out and buy a $3,000 camera to do those pieces of content. You do not have to have a very robust video editing rig to do that. You can do that content with a smartphone. You can do that content with a decent webcam. You can do that content with a $100 microphone. The barrier to entry for doing gaming or commentary, with gaming, you got to have a console. Okay? You don't necessarily have to have the latest and greatest console, but the barrier to entry there is relatively low. With gaming, you could even do online games, and then you just need a decent enough computer to do it, or you could do mobile gaming. So the barrier to entry financially to the niches I talked about, and they're not the only ones, but those three niches have a less than $1,000 or sometimes less than $500 barrier to entry. They also don't require you to be an expert at anything. So that's why most young people gravitate toward making that type of content. But then that's why it's saturated, and that's why it's also highly competitive, and that's why it becomes very difficult to stand out. But if we're talking about anything that has to do with business, technology, careers, money, you have to be able to back that stuff up. You have to be able to prove that. So it's actually very hard, ridiculously hard, for anyone under 25 or anyone under 30 to make career-driven content, money content, or advice of any kind with any type of legitimacy, because who's going to take that advice from somebody who doesn't have a lot of lived experience? It's very hard to be able to claim 10 years of experience in anything at that point. So the thing is, for those of you who are older, you're over 30, you have distinct advantages in markets where, yes, there's not as much of a big audience sometimes, but you also have less competition because of the barrier to entry. And then also the level of quality that's acceptable in those niches is much higher and will continue to get higher and higher. And the other thing about that is the advantage of those niches is they frankly just pay better. Entertainers have to have massive, large audiences to be able to make six or seven figures. But content creators in domains of experience do not need larger audiences to accomplish that same feat. It's smaller audiences with higher levels of disposable income. So that's, you know, that's a very different way to approach things. That's a very different strategy. It's a very different strategy. So there's the difference here. If we want to talk about CPM and RPM rates, cost per mil, revenue per mil rates, what you get in take-home pay on the ads, let me put it to you like this. If you're a content creator in entertainment or commentary, you would be very lucky to get a tenth of a penny per view on YouTube. One tenth of a penny per view on YouTube. If you are an education-based channel, you could be making as much as a penny per view on YouTube. Be making a penny per view on YouTube. It's a 10x difference. The 10x difference. And what I mean by that is this. Let me put this in terms more of you might understand. If you are a viral content creator on YouTube and you do entertainment content and your name is not Mr. Beast, you're lucky to get $500 to $1,000 for a million views on YouTube. But if I did the same million views on YouTube on my channel currently, for every 1 million views, I will make $8,000 to $10,000 on that same video in ad revenue alone. In ad revenue alone. In fact, in ad revenue this year, off of about 2.3 million views for 2021, 3.2 million views for 2021, if I take YouTube Brand Connect money out of the equation, 2.3 million views, I believe, has made me about $36,000. So that's a really, really valuable piece of information you just got there. is that on my YouTube channel, because I have not been uploading consistently, in fact, I took about over 45 days between uploads because I moved in October. So I basically took all of November and some change off. And again, my channel doesn't make viral content, and I do have some videos that get views. And I know sometimes because I have 500,000 subscribers, people dunk on me when my uploads don't get like 50,000 views, but that's not the way I make my content. I'm not making broad audience content. But here's the difference. The difference is 2.3 million views in a year for me to earn $36,000 on ad revenue alone. Strategic relationships that resulted in me making over $100,000 in brand deal relationships alone, over $100,000 in brand deals, and also my own products and services through my coaching business, through my channel being a funnel for that, without me even selling a $500 course. I don't sell a $500 course, not yet. I will, and it'll be great, and I'll put other courses to shame. In fact, my petty goal is to make courses that make every other course that exists look like an embarrassment. That's my petty goal, because I'm competitive. But the thing is, I don't even sell a $500 course, and my coaching and membership and my $99 graphic bundles have produced over $100,000 this year for AwesomeCreatorAcademy.com. So between brand deals and sponsorships, each of those verticals was $100,000. And then I probably did about close to $100,000 or so in affiliate revenue alone. So for the year so far, and the year's not finished, it's over $360,000 in revenue. I mean, it's a spoiler alert because I'm going to have a video next year, how much did YouTube pay me in 2021? And I'm somewhat spoiling it. I mean, the final calculations aren't in, but it's over $360,000 for the year or so far. So it's, and I don't say that as a humble brag. There are creators who make infinitely more money than me. Graham Stephan, Andre Geek, Beat Kevin, Financial Education Jeremy. There are so many creators who make infinitely more from me just on AdSense alone. It's not even close. You have the Mr. Beast of the world, obviously, and people like Mark Rober. So it's not even close. But I'm also not pulling the kind of views that they're pulling. They pull the kind of views that I'm talking about making in a year on a single video. So it's not even close. So for me, but again, for me uploading less than a video a week the entire year and still doing 36,000 ad revenue is a very, very healthy situation. And I live in Georgia. I don't live in California, New York. So lifestyle-wise, between that affiliate revenue, affiliate being truly passive, non-hustle income, probably amounting to 75,000 of the truly passive side of the affiliate side. I mean, it'd be a healthy living. It'd still be six figures. It'd be a very healthy living off of ad revenue and affiliate, but I also had the brand deals. So it's very healthy at that point. And then I have my other business. So extraordinarily healthy. And I'm blessed with a great community. And I'm blessed with great relationships that I built over the course of the last decade. So those are the things that scale what I'm talking about doing. But I as I told you, next year, because we haven't even talked about my main YouTube channel plan for 2022. I'll tell you about my main YouTube channel plan for 2022. When I was at the peak of putting out consistent content, I was putting out 100 to 150 videos a year. And in doing 100 to 150 videos a year, I was gaining about 8 million or so views. But at that time, my ad rates were not what they are today. If I were getting 8 million views today, based on my current revenue projections, we're talking about making three times as much in ad revenue as I did this year at doing less than 40 or so videos at 2.3 million views. So if I did 40 or so videos and I did 2.3 million views, let's say that I went back to my peak and my individual videos were not even getting as many views per video now. So at the end, we could make a reasonable assumption and tell me if you think this is reasonable. If I put out three videos a week on my main channel in 2022, so let's say, let's round that to 150 videos. And let's just make the assumption that I did what I used to do when I was getting less views per upload, but being more consistent, 8 million conservatively in views, or even 10 million. Then we're talking about making between three and four times what I just did in ad revenue. And at 36,000 in ad revenue on 2.3, 2.5 million views, well, what we're talking about now is we're talking about going to six figures in ad revenue alone. We're talking about potentially knowing that on a million views per million, I'll get between 8,000 and 10,000. Let's even round that down to the conservative estimate of 8,000 per million views. Well, then if we're being super conservative, we're being hyper conservative about this, then we're talking about an ad revenue alone between 64 and 80,000. Now, again, I think it'd be more than that, but that's a conservative estimate. Realistically, it would be 100,000 in ad revenue just for me to return to my 2018 upload schedule. If I return to my 2018 upload schedule, that's the difference we're talking about in ad revenue for me potentially. And it's also making assumption that my videos will not perform as well as they, it's making the assumption my videos would not perform as well as they are right now. So that is what that would look like. Now, if we make a reasonable assumption that that level of traffic boosts my other revenue streams, then it would theoretically double them, but we could be more conservative than that and just say it'd be a 1.5 multiplier instead of a 2x multiplier. And then that's very significant as well. So it becomes very reasonable for me to scale this. But of course, in my case, I invest more than 50% or so back into my business. So don't think that this is me like pocketing this money. This would be me scaling the business. This would be me increasing the quality, increasing the number of channels, increasing the types of content, investing in more team and trying to do more with less in terms of time, because I am getting older and I'm still not married with kids. So I want to start a family. I want to travel. I want to do other things. My value as a coach will go up, so I'll have to charge more for my time. I'll want to work less hours, so I'll have to hire more people. So just making more money would not be a good trade for giving up more of my time as I start to get older and my priorities are changing. My priorities have had to change because I've become a homeowner this year, which is why I had to take 45 days off from uploading at all. I took 45 days from uploading to my main YouTube channel, which I'm going to do a video about, because my priorities had to change during an important move and the transition to becoming a homeowner and getting settled and getting this office set up. Even this week, I had to deal with contractors to get the Ethernet set up so that things like live streaming can be more consistent. So now I have wired hardline ports in every room now. There's Ethernet in every room now. And that was important to get set up to be able to make this all practical and make this work. I had to get this home office set up, which there will be a tour, to make it wildly practical to be able to make this kind of content. And the future of making my content practical is me giving up the video editing, which means hiring a full-time video editor. That's going to cost money. So it's important to make more money to be able to hire people to buy back your time so that you can put family first and you don't have to be a workaholic. There's a healthy version of hustling. There's a healthy version of scaling content. There's a healthy version of doing all of these things, but you have to be willing to do what it takes to get to that place. And you have to know when you are there and know what comes next and what it means and what it looks like and what to do. And so hiring a full-time editor, hiring two full-time editors actually is wildly practical, because then you need a backup to a backup. If taking editing off my plate is giving it to someone else, well, I have to account for the fact that they might get sick or they might have priorities or they might have to step away. So you have to have, in my case, that means two full-time editors, two full-time salaries. That means that you have to scale the business. That means you have to bring in another six figures to be able to pay your people and take care of them. You have to do that. If you're going to have two full-time employees for redundancy in something that's essential to the business's operation, you're going to have to make another $100,000 a year to make that work. At least another $100,000 a year to make that work, to be able to pay them well and to be able to ensure that they have all the resources they need, because you don't want to rely on their ability to buy a laptop, buy this, buy that. You need to be able to give them whatever they need. You need to be able to resource your people. So you have to make another 100,000 to a quarter million to bring in two or three more people to your organization to be able to make sure that they're properly resourced and properly supported and properly compensated. You have to. And so that's a really smart way to scale a business. And it's something most YouTubers don't talk about. You'll watch different things and you won't hear about this side of it. But why do we need to make more money? How much money is enough? Well, how much money is there in, how much money do you need to take care of people? How many people are you responsible for taking care of? Well, what do they need? And what is taking care of them really look like? What does that realistically look like? So making sure that people are not are adequately compensated, that's one thing. Making sure that they have another person to support them is another thing. Making sure that they have the resources they need to do their job as fast as possible and as well as possible, well, that's another thing entirely. In my case, it's that it's not an accident that I, by the way, have literally some of the most expensive and best camera gear, and I have like literally almost every Sony lens. I want to be able to know that if I need somebody to do something for me, I can put a camera in their hands, and it's one of the best that they could have, and that there's almost no way for them to miss a shot or get the thing wrong. I want to be able to put the fastest memory card in that thing to make sure that they've got it. I want them to have a camera that has two memory card slots so there's no way to lose the footage. I want to know that I've given people every opportunity to succeed and get the job right when I put something in their hands and I ask them to go to work. Now, that's just my philosophy of how you deal with people. That's how you set people up for success. It's how I wish things had been done with me by my employers and my clients in the past, is I would like to have been fully set up for success, and I don't feel I always was. So that's important. Building, it's going to take me a lot of investment to build the studio that I'm building in the basement. Studio in the basement is going to have fully functional, multiple fully functional editing stations. So just doing the framing, the soundproofing and sound dampening, the drywall, the drop ceiling, that's a massive investment in the space. It's over 330 square feet, so that's very expensive to do. But then after that, I have to supply that to set up people to work with me and to be able to do their job as best as possible. And then after that, I'm actually, there's another room. It's about maybe 240 square feet in the basement. And I'm having that refinished because it wasn't done right the first time, not by me, but by the previous owners. And I'm having that refinished, and I'm having that probably soundproofed because that's going to become a podcast studio modular. But I'm also going to build a sound booth. I'm going to build a sound booth into the basement. That's going to be the next year to 2 years. And part of the reason is having the capacity and ability for me to record the audiobook versions of any books that I write and be able to do it and do it well and do it properly from right here, the comfort of my home office, by doing it downstairs in the basement, is having that. Now, that sounds extra and that sounds extravagant. And yes, I understand that these are very nice privileged problems to have in that situation, but I also worked for it for a very long time. And again, it is a way that I'm investing my money to invest back into my community, because I've decided the long form thing that I want to do is I'm going to create books. I'm actually finished in the last 2 months. I finished 80% of my book in 60 days. Just sat there and I just hammered it out. That's part of my other content strategy is you'll be getting books from me. You'll be getting blogs from me. You'll be getting articles, and I'm going to repurpose them to put them in as many places as possible so that there's almost no way for the knowledge to be lost. And the way to preserve knowledge is by writing books. And so it's going to be physical books, digital books, and audiobooks. And that's my plan. And so for me, the plan is to release a full book probably every other year, and some type of micro book or mini book or smaller book in between that, and maybe do that for the rest of my life, like Seth Godin, basically write a book every year for the rest of my life. And the thing is, I feel like I'm capable of it. I feel like I've made enough content to justify it. I think there's enough topics for me to cover, and I think that there's enough things that I can do to make those things as evergreen as possible. And the good news for me is that if I create the sound booth, recording studio downstairs in a podcasting room. One, that lends itself to opportunities that make collaborating with me more valuable to other people and my peers in terms of a resource play. It definitely means that I have the convenience to be able to make something of the highest quality whenever I want. It's the same thing with setting up the basement to have the full editing space for my team, and also for me to have my own photo studio down there. It is that I will be able to produce the highest quality. Like, this is what I'm trying to also get you all to understand. The way that I spend the money that I make in this community is to literally invest back into giving my community the highest quality thing that I am capable of. And that's why you're now basically getting as many podcasts as I can put out. I made it easier on myself to be able to do this and to be able to give you guys higher quality stuff. It's why I think that I can make 100 to 150 pieces of core content next year. Whether it's 100 or 150 videos for the main YouTube channel, I think it'll be easier to do from now on. I think I can get to 100, 150, maybe more episodes of the podcast in 2020 because I've made it easier now to make the content. And to make it not only easier, but easier to make the highest quality content possible. And so that is what I've been putting the money back into. That's why I spend over 50% of what I make directly back into this business, to invest it back into giving my community the best, because I've made it a commitment to that. I've decided that the community and audience I serve, there's a lot of other people who've moved into the same space as me. There are a lot of people that are wanting to be competitive in that space, and that's great. And they bring something new and fresh to the table. What I don't think everyone will bring is the level of commitment to going extra that I plan to, both in quality and quantity. I used to be the quantity guy, and the quality was good enough. Now I've spent a little bit of time while working on myself, especially the last 2 years with the pandemic. I've had to work on myself, work on my mental health. But at the same time, you may have noticed something. I've been trying constantly every year to increase the quality of my production and of my content. Every year I've done that. I've stepped up, and it made it unsustainable to be consistent. I think I finally have found the balance that will allow for quality and quantity. And I think by having a team, we can add a level of ridiculous scale to that and take quantity to an even more absurd place through scale and repurposing. But its foundation is 100 to 150 main channel videos and 100 to 150 podcast episodes. And that will give us the foundations for scaling everything else and making 1,000 pieces of content out of that and doing it in different ways. It allows us to make micro content for YouTube Shorts, TikTok, Instagram Reels, all of that, and scale. It allows us to take the podcast and then have all these audio distribution variants of that. We're also going to do 100 pieces of original short form content and not just repurposed. We're going to do 100, like we're figuring it out. I'm going to do 100 of my own motivational quotes as YouTube Shorts / TikTok / Instagram Reels. And it'll be content that's not repurposed from a core video, but it will literally be, here we go. I'm just going to make 100 pieces of motivational content in short form that are made in short form for the platform that way. And so that's the real way that we're going to approach it. The other thing is, there's other types of content. Because on my weekends, I do my own photography, especially I do wildlife photography. We know that I can make 1,000. We know that I can get 1,000 really good shots that are worth posting. And so we know that there are 1,000 really good shots for me to do on a different Instagram page. There is 1,000 really good shots for me to do for my Pinterest account. We know that we can take those shots and we can post them to my Twitter, and we know we can post them to my Facebook, and we know that there's value in doing that. And we know that we can take the best of my shots, and we know that we can put them up as prints for people to buy in my store. I have a store, createawesomethings.com, where people can buy my wildlife prints. So we know that there's a way to scale my own personal photography if I want to, and to share that and to have that be out there. So we know that there won't be like an NFT play for at least another 2 years, because I'm thinking next level on that, because I'm thinking of a legacy play. If I do an NFT, which I will eventually, my NFT is going to be what I've been talking about in Twitter. If you have been following me on Twitter, my NFT is going to be buying a pass to being part of a secret society. Like, spoiler alert, because this is not where this one was going, but I'll give you guys a little bit of a spoiler alert. When I do my NFT project, and I can't stand these crypto scammers and these rug pulls. You have to understand, when I do things, I'm a little petty sometimes. So when I do things with the goal of saying, this is what doing it right looks like, and embarrassing people who want to do things halfway, because I'm petty. And I'm competitive. When I say petty, I'm using that as a slang term for I'm competitive, right? So just understand what I mean, right? So in 2 years or more, 2 or 3 years, whatever it looks like, my NFT is a legacy token. And my NFT, when I do my legacy token, is a pass to being part of my secret society. Because what I believe is that NFTs outside of crypto art, but even if you wanted to do, because I believe in the technology of blockchain more than I do the crypto art play, but I won't just do like a crypto art play. That would just be what the face of something looks like. And that's fine. And like, I believe in that because I believe in collectibles. I was a Yu-Gi-Oh! Magic Gathering Pokemon kid growing up. People didn't understand that. People thought I was wasting money. People didn't believe in it. I understand people dunking on nerd culture and things that they're not a part of. They bullied people for playing World of Warcraft and living in that world too. So I'm used to people judging things they don't understand and things they're not a part of. There are people, they don't like to admit, there are people who judge people who are part of Greek life, who are in fraternities and sororities. But the reality is that communities and cultures that you're not a part of aren't really your place to judge. I mean, obviously, it's a free country. You can have your opinions about it, and that's fine. But the level of judgment for existing outside of a culture or community is really annoying to me, because you're not a part of that. So you dunking on it, oh, wow, that's really big of you. Like, you're not a part of that. You don't get to judge what those people want to be a part of and where they find belonging. And that's what I see like NFT communities being. NFT communities are a culture and a community and a group that are insiders on a thing. They're all in that together, and they're being bullied and judged by people who exist outside of their group and outside of their culture and outside of their club and outside of their clique. And there are other cultures and clubs and groups that they won't judge. Like, you'll feel annoyed with, and you'll kind of judge people who are part of a country club community, but you're not really dunking on them. Why? Because you are insecure, because you know they have more money than you. So it's like hard to dunk on people who are part of the country club set because, oh, well, they got more money than you. It's hard to dunk on people if you don't play golf, who play golf because it's a really expensive hobby. There's a level of pretentiousness to it. And you know, it's like you look envious and jealous and stupid dunking on these rich people playing golf just because you don't. People know that. Oh, you judge, or people who are athletes or gym rats, you know that you look insecure doing that. So, but the thing is, there is no real penalties socially for judging NFT communities and dunking on them. So that's why people do it. In the same way that there was no real judgment for dunking on kids who want to play Yu-Gi-Oh!, Magic Gathering, or Dungeons & Dragons. People dunked on that and bullied people for that too, that exist outside of the culture, until it became more mainstream and normalized. I was there and part of the cosplay community when people were dunking on people who wanted to pay money to dress authentically as their favorite superhero. And I've been part of these communities for a very long time that have been misunderstood and bullied by people who exist outside their culture. So I see no difference here. So with what I would do with an NFT play is, my NFT play is people who want to be part of my secret society, people who want to be part of my group, people who want to be a part of my club. And then the perks for being part of my club would be whatever I decide that they're going to be, but it is an exclusivity play, and it is a lifetime pass type of situation is what mine would look like. So it would be buying a lifetime pass to something, and it would be being part of unique experiences that you only get to have as a token holder. And the thing is, my token holders would have an exclusive community that other people do not get to be a part of. And therefore they have exclusive experiences that people don't get to have be a part of. And so for me, it's a level of access. It's a level of access that's no different than if you belong to a fraternity or a sorority. And the thing is, the NFT is the same thing as having the secret codes, having the secret handshake, having the decoder ring. An NFT is nothing more than a decoder ring that lets people who are in your club and in your community know that you're one of them in that regard. If you make it that way, there's other ways and applications of it, but this is the way I view it. And this is the way that I would be doing it. The way that I would be doing it would be I'd be building a real community and it would be part of an exclusive experience. And there's no way to forge it. There's no way to fake it. You're in or you're out. You know, and that's the way I would be doing it. So mine, when I do this, my version of it is I'm literally just going to build a secret society. And if you're an outsider, you're an outsider, and you don't have to get it. You don't have to get it. You don't have to understand it. And it's not your place to judge it. You're not one of us at that point. And again, I know that sounds pretentious and it sounds elitist, but that's the thing. What a club is it's supposed to be. That's what a secret club is. That's what a friend group is. That's what a clique is. There's insiders and there's outsiders, and that's how it is. And there are a lot of people who have had to be outsiders their whole life that are looking for a place where they actually belong. And the thing is, where they're not going to be judged and where their values are shared. And what I see is I see the niches that we see in social media. When I see online groups, when I see Discord servers, when I see these things, that's what I see. Is I see people that may have grew up in small towns, been disenfranchised, weren't ever allowed to be a part of something for one reason or another, looking for their people and the place that they are belonging and finding that. And the problem that they're running into is the same problem that you run into the real world. If you do that, you know, like kids, I even see it here in the chat. You know, the kids who played Dungeons and Dragons, everyone thought that they were like part of a cult or they were doing something wrong and everything. Now it's popular though. Now it's popular enough without you being a super nerd, but you were judged and you were bullied for that. People who, like some of you probably know, some of you probably played Yu-Gi-Oh or Pokemon or Magic the Gathering and you were bullied for it. And people probably thought you were part of a cult too, or that you were doing something wrong. And I'm not saying there's nothing bad or grimy or shady that ever happens in the world of crypto. I'm not saying that. That's obviously true. But there's bad, shady, grimy stuff that happens in every group, every culture, every community, every technology, every system. And the thing is, a lot of us have already grown up in it and we've already seen it and we've already been the victims of those things and everything. Those things are still allowed to exist, by the way. Those things that, you know, did that, they're still allowed to exist. Like, you know, you want to worry about things like, and I'm not saying there's not legitimate things, but if you want to worry about money laundering, tax evasion, illicit activity, you don't start with the crypto community. You start with Congress. You don't start with the crypto community. You start with sitting members of Congress. Yeah, I said it. So again, not to get like, you know, political on this show, because that's not really what we're doing here, unless we're talking about social media legislation or technology legislation. But again, like, you want to talk about accountability, you want to talk about corruption, you want to talk about things to be concerned about, you want to talk about tax evasion, money laundering, illicit activity, you start with the sitting members of Congress. You start with the sitting members of Congress. Then you start with the financial institutions. And then you start with all the government agencies and all the government adjacent industries and institutions. You don't start with crypto. You start with institutionalized powers that have existed for hundreds of years with impunity, not technology that's been around for less than 20. Yeah, I said it. So like I said, for me, an NFT play, there might be some experiments here or there, but my real NFT project, when I do one eventually, whether it's 2 years from now or whether it's 5 years from now, is that I want to make some type of lifetime token that allows people to be part of my secret society. And, you know, and I use the word secret society like you do when you're a child, when you're a kid, like it's, oh, I have my club, I have my clique, I have my friends. It's like, I want to build a next level intimate community of people that will have been invested in me, that get a special level of access, special benefits, and get to be part of exclusive experiences and events IRL. And again, well, what does that mean? Because that sounds really vague, Roberto. It's like, well, what does that mean? Well, we already know I do public speaking. I go to events and I'm a public speaker, right? Imagine that if you are showing up to one of my speaking engagements at an event like Vid Summit, VidCon, Social Media Marketing World, something like that, imagine that there is, you know, a special event within the event. And this happens, by the way, event within the event. Being invited to the event within the event that I'm hosting means you would have to be a part of my membership. You'd have to be a part of my secret society. You'd have to be a token holder to be able to go to that special dinner with just us, because that's what that is. Just like every fraternity, just like every sorority, just like all these other elite groups, there's an inner group and so there's an inner circle. So this is a buy-in to the inner circle is the way that I would do it. And so that's what that would, that's one version of what that would look like. Another one could be that it's lifetime access to a digital vault that I give exclusive assets to, because I could have my team, because this is the other thing with scaling a team. I could have my team making exclusive assets that we never sell that only exist for our community. I could be giving special one-on-ones that exist as a lifetime token holder, is that, hey, in your lifetime membership, maybe it's that within a certain time period, you get to have 3 one-on-one calls with me in your lifetime of your membership. And the thing about that is, well, because you paid upfront to be a token holder, you're not paying whatever the cost inflates to as I become more valuable over time in my career because you got in early. So this, it'd look like that. It'd be something like that. In my case, that's what it would theoretically look like. And the reason that it's taking maybe 2, 3, or 5 years before we get there for me is the fact that I would want to do it right, and I would want to do it better than everyone else. Because again, I'm competitive, I'm petty. I would want to do it better than most other people, or at least other people at my level. So for me, it wouldn't be a long-term cash grab or cash play. And the thing is, for all I know, it'll be invite only. For all I know, the ability to even buy my NFT will be a limited exclusive experience that not everyone publicly even gets to even have the opportunity to participate in, because I'm not about a cash grab. I will not want to have a lifetime relationship with just anybody. I will not want just anybody to have whatever value or utility my token provides. I will not want that in the hands of just anybody. I will not want just anyone to be part of my secret society. So it may not even be something that anyone in the general public can even buy to even stress about or even care about or ever judge. For all you know, most of you, like, it might even be literally that in 3 or 5 years, you won't even know that I did an NFT project, because you might not even be on the list of people that get to participate in it, because I might take it that level. I'm not guaranteeing this, by the way. I'm thinking out loud. Stream of consciousness, live stream. I might literally not allow just anybody or the general public to even be able to get one of my tokens. I might literally choose who even gets that opportunity, and it might be a very small list. Because again, it's a lifetime. It's a, like I said, it is literally, the way I think of it is a fraternity or a sorority or a secret society. And you don't get to just, not just anybody gets to join a fraternity or a sorority or a secret society. Not just anybody gets to do that. There are qualifiers. Not just anybody gets to do that. Not just anyone gets to have that relationship. Not everyone gets to have that sisterhood or brotherhood or that camaraderie. Not everyone gets to do that. There are qualifiers. There's a selection process. So why would I not do it any differently then? So like, and it protects the experience of the group. Yeah, this person has it right. Makes sense, so you keep out people who will give unnecessary grief to others in the group. Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's a loyalty play. It's a loyalty play. And that's how I view it. And some people say, doesn't that sound an awful like a cult or a blah, blah, blah? I'm like, it is literally the same as Greek life and sorority life and country clubs. It is the same. And again, in my case, there'd be structured the same. There'd be bylaws. There'd be this, there'd be that. So like for me, it would be about creating experiences for our group. It would be about collective resources, community investment. And again, because an NFT is also a smart contract, there's a way to digitally enforce certain things that you want to happen. So that's the way that it would play out. So, so that's how I think about these things is I try to think about them very intentionally and very deeply. And for me, it wouldn't be a cash grab or a rug pull. It's like, this is a lifetime commitment of being part of something and being part of a community. And it has to be people who respect the community and the rules and the other people that are their brothers and sisters in this group. And that would be the way that I would want to do it. That's how I would want it to be, because that's what I would want to. When I join things, and I'm not a joiner, that's the thing. I'm not a joiner because I've understood what it is to be excluded and left out or not a part of something, or to be made a part of something and then it not be what was promised, or like, you know, you're a part of a group, but you're on the bottom of that group that you're a part of, you know? And I've been there. So the thing is, I'm not a joiner. You might notice a stunning lack of collaborations. Most YouTubers at my level are very clicky. Most people with 500,000 subscribers or 100,000 subscribers, very clicky, very, very much so. Always looking to do collabs, and there's nothing wrong with it, nothing wrong, and no judgment here. But it's like, you'll notice that I don't do a lot of collabs, and I'm not very clicky in that way with other big YouTubers, and that I actually hang out with a lot of small YouTubers. You may have noticed that. You may have noticed that I spend the most time collaborating with, live streaming with, partnering with people who are small YouTubers and not my peers that have hundreds of thousands of subscribers. And there's a reason why I don't join. So I would want to make something that people would feel very good about joining and being a part of. And I would want them to have a great experience. And I would want them to feel respected. I'd want them to feel valued. I'd want them to feel seen and heard. I would desperately want that for the people that are in my community, because I know what it's like to not have it. I know what it's like to not have that. So yeah, so that's what it looks like. In some ways, so if you think about it the right way, on the other hand, the token holders would probably benefit long-term if it's not a secret. There's a level to which something is secret, meaning that you might know about something's existence, but you may not know all the details. So we can know that a fraternity or a sorority exists, but we don't know all the details of what being a part of that particular organization, what all the benefits and details and what all the experiences are. And that's on purpose. So that's what that would look like if depending on your execution. And again, I'm giving you the rough skeleton of my philosophy and thought process around how I would execute a project like that. But again, that's a building block and that's a layer deeper, because again, for the reason that this is so far out is there's things I have to focus on before that. So what I have to focus on before that is I have to focus on finishing my first book, my second book, and my third book. My first book, my second book, and my third book all precede doing any of this nonsense. Like, and by nonsense, I'm just jokingly saying, like, it's a lot to do. It's overwhelming. But before I do anything, it's like I have to finish the first book, second book, probably the third book. What I also have to do is I have two new starter kits that come out next year. We just released the Brand Deal starter kit. It's linked in the description if you want to check it out, and in the show notes of the podcast. So we have the Brand Deal starter kit that we released in 2021 at the fourth quarter. I have another starter kit. Actually, I have two starter kits that I'm releasing in 2022. Probably the brand. We did the Brand Deals starter kit. So it'll be the live streaming and podcasters starter kits will be releasing 2022. So those are big projects. There is other things that I'm working on. Obviously, the book and everything that goes along with doing the book. I am keynoting at several events already in 2022, pending that we don't have more problems with COVID. And on top of that, there's everything I'm doing with continuing to invest in the music channel and the copyright-free music and things with that. So there's a lot. And like I said, we're committing to making 100 videos on the main channel next year. There's always the hiring of new people, and there's the renovations that I'm doing to build the studio downstairs. So there's a lot of work to do before I can entertain the idea of a massive long-term NFT project. There's a lot more to do. There's a lot more to learn, and there's a lot more to execute on before I even consider moving forward with that. But I have been working on it in the background and doing everything in my research. I also have to look at, I want to do it at a point in time when the gas fees are lower, the carbon footprint is lower, because I've taken those things in consideration. I'm looking for some of the technological parts of it to develop more. So what I am working on in the background is what the value proposition is for my people and what experience I'm going to create for my people. And then who gets to participate? Who are my people? Like, so that's the thoughtfulness around that. But I don't want to do it halfway, in the same way that I keep wanting to bring value to every piece of content I make. I would want to bring value to every token holder. So for me, if you may have noticed, I don't do short-term plays, not really. I don't do short-term plays. In fact, one of the reasons that I've been reluctant or hesitant up until now to do massive short-form content plays with TikTok, Instagram Reels, Facebook Reels, YouTube Shorts, one of the reasons that I'm looking at this is I look at utility. I mean, think about it. I don't even make entertainment content. I make utility content. Think about it. I make utility content. I don't even make entertainment content. I'm not even entertaining. So what? When I look at, well, what am I going to do? It's going to be something that is a utility play and something that's a community play, because utility and community are the areas that I focus on more than I do on entertainment or status. So it's going to be like that. And then from a value play situation, again, if you may have noticed, I don't set up my products and services in any way, shape, or form to appeal to or to try to take advantage of people who don't have money. I only sell to people who already have money. I only sell to people who have money and disposable income. And other than that, the goal is to make as much free and affordable and available content, $0 to almost nothing for people who need help or need those things. But what I won't do is, like, it's not going to be, getting my time will always cost money. Getting my time will always cost money. As far as I'm concerned, getting my time should always cost the most money. And I think that should be true for all of you as well. And so I'm trying to also lead by example on that. So getting my time outside of the content that I choose to make or participating in a live experience is, like, the rest of that is, all right, if you don't have money, watch the $0 content. Writing the books is going to be, here's the deep dive of, like, my thought process and my brain in the right structure and order in a book, because a book in my mind is the next best thing. It's like, okay, the stuff that I would put in a course that I would sell for $500, I can put in a book, but a book is not edited videos by me and my team. And the reason I will be making $500 courses in the future year after year is going to be, well, my team is going to be working on those courses, and my team needs to be paid. So not only do I need to be paid for my time and my work and my effort, but so does my team. I don't really think I need to justify it beyond that. And again, people who can't pay for that, well, you can watch my $0 content or you can buy my book. Those are affordable things for people who can't afford those things. So, like, there's something that is appropriate to the situation that people are in, and they can determine their own level of involvement. And then for higher level plays, it's going to be like things like, again, you come to a conference, that's a big ticket item. You pay for one-on-one time for me, that's a big ticket item, for as long as that's available. But when I have a family, that's going to be something that's either wildly expensive. Once I have kids, buying my time, like get it in, like get in coaching and stuff like that while I'm single. Because when I get married and I have kids, the value of my time will exponentially increase because it will be taken from them whenever I give it out. So the price will go up and that will be non-negotiable. The minute that I start my family, buying my time will become wildly expensive. And I am making no qualms about that. I'm not apologizing. The minute that I bring a child into this world, my time becomes the least accessible it will ever be. That's facts. That's facts. And I think everybody should abide by that, by the way. Not just me. Like, I think everybody should abide by that. The minute that I bring a child into this world, my prices will become wildly expensive to buy my time. The needle will probably not move on my products, but on my time, oh yes, you better believe the minute that I bring a child into this world, the price of my time goes up. It won't even be close. And I'm not playing. So that's what that looks like. Now, like I was saying though, I think in long-term plays, it's why I've been bearish on short-form content, but I've figured out how to make short-form content that might work with my personality. Her Healthy Home says, I started telling people to watch my videos if they can't afford my course. I have over 350 videos. It's hard because I feel for those people who can't afford it, but I have to support mine. Don't feel bad. Don't feel bad at all. It's a healthy and appropriate boundary to set your time as something that is extraordinarily valued and you'll never get back. And it also comes at the expense of time that you're giving to your family. So if you have kids, you have a spouse, you have a significant other, price accordingly. Price accordingly. If you, whatever you were charging before you had a significant other or a spouse, whatever you were charging before you have a child, I won't hesitate to tell you, maybe you double it. Maybe you double it. Because it's one thing when you are taking time away from yourself. It's another thing entirely when you're taking time away from your family. It's another thing entirely. And so I absolutely, unapologetically will tell anybody that's thinking about raising their rates that maybe you double them. Maybe you double them. And yeah, it means that every yes you get will be worth it because it'll be a boundary that you feel comfortable with and that is appropriate and you won't regret it. So you have to, with that, you have to charge what you won't regret when it comes to time that gets taken away from your family, especially children, especially when they're really young and it's like there's everything's a first. Everything's a first. Like, you'll never get that back. So if it's a choice or a compromise or a hedge, better charge for it. So that's my thought. That's just one man's point of view. Also, it's really good to prices if you're an entrepreneur, especially if you're a female entrepreneur, but actually not even if you're just a female entrepreneur, if you're a potential parent or soon to be parent, if you are trading your time for money, you should price paternity leave into your pricing structure. You should price your own paternity leave into your business model. You should also charge to have redundancy in your business model, to have employees that can pick up the slack for your paternity leave. That's a business thing that I don't think almost anyone in our space talks about. And so, yeah, like I think you should stop feeling guilty about the price you charge for things because people who can't afford it can work on the free content. It's not your place to, it's not your responsibility to make people make those things accessible to them at your expense or the expense of your family or the expense of your team. It is not your place to discount your time, your talent, or your skills or your team because of other people's circumstances. Not if you're making free content. If you're making free $0 content, you have no other obligation to what people can't afford because it starts at zero. Everything else is a choice. Just one man's point of view. Frost, what's up, buddy? Says buy the dip on Roberto's time. Yeah, buy the dip. Yes, so Scott, with regard to, and then we're gonna wrap up the show here in a minute, and then we'll move into a lightning round for after the show. So make sure you're part of the live experience for the lightning rounds. But Scott says, are you talking about doing native TikTok versus YouTube Shorts? I saw YouTube Shorts creator Fun mention not repurposing TikTok content and some other parameters. So here are my thoughts when it comes to YouTube Shorts and the repurposing guidelines with regard to TikTok. TikTok doesn't have the same rule, if I'm not mistaken, with regard to their creator fund, which means that the way that I plan to do it and the way I think people should do it and the way that I'm planning to do it is YouTube Shorts first, make the thing for YouTube Shorts and let YouTube Shorts have it first. And then you repurpose it to the other platforms instead of the other way around. And when they say don't repurpose, what they mean is, oh, they don't want you uploading something that has a TikTok, that has the TikTok logo and all that. Okay, fine. Natively upload the same content on each of the other platforms, but timing-wise, let it hit YouTube first and then put it everywhere else. So make the master file and then upload it to YouTube Shorts first. Then upload it to Instagram Reels, then upload it to TikTok, then upload it to Snapchat, then upload it to Twitter. Oh, and Facebook, because Facebook's coming with the bag now. So just upload native video and edit it and have it and take the native video file and upload it to all those other places, or be really smart and hire an assistant to do that part for you. Boom. Hiya. Hey, what's up, Audriemba? So yes, Scott, secure the bag. Secure the bag. Creator Wizard, what's up, man? Gabe, how are you doing? So yeah, those are my thoughts, and these are my plans around making the 1,000 pieces of content in 2020. You have a really good outline for my thoughts around this. You also got a sneak peek at my thoughts on NFTs, even though we're not making that. I'm going to make a dedicated podcast episode about the NFT thing. I'm going to probably bring on a guest. But Creator Wizard, Justin, like, if the idea of repurposing is exhausting, my thought on that is that you build a team around you to do it internally, or you get a part, you partner with a company like Jellysmack that can do it for you. So that's what my thought would be. I would love to actually bring on Hugo from the Jellysmack team onto the podcast. I'll probably reach out to him, see if he can come on the show as an interview, and then we could talk about the value of repurposing content. We could talk about Jellysmack. So that's something to look forward to. But guys, I'm going to wrap up the episode of the podcast here. I want to thank everybody. But before the live audience leaves, I want to remind the live audience that you get to be part of the lightning round after the show. So make sure you're staying tuned. If you're in the audio only audience, you're missing out by not subscribing to the YouTube channel and turning on notifications so that you can be part of the live viewing experience and get little things like shout outs or have your questions answered on the live show or be part of the lightning round Q&A. So make sure you're doing that. Make sure you're reviewing, subscribing, doing all of the things.
Thank you for listening to the Create Something Awesome Today podcast. Hungry for more creative and practical ideas? Why not visit createsomethingawesometoday.com and access all resources and links mentioned in today's show, as well as special bonus content that Roberto regularly crafts for you. Now, go create something awesome today. Createsomethingawesometoday.com.